This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As the world warms, we face declining snowpack and more summer droughts. New science discovers a key temperature point governing that relationship. Beyond it, winter snowpacks do not accumulate, and summer drought affecting hundreds of millions of people likely follows. This is another sign of human-forced global warming, but forecasting snow storage is anything but simple. Finally, we have the paper, Evidence of Human Influence on Northern Hemisphere Snow Loss. The lead author is PhD student Alexander R. Gottlieb, publishing with Justin Mankin. Both are with the Climate Modeling and Impacts Group at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Together, over the years, they published a series of investigations into climate and snowpack. Alexander Gottlieb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, most snow accumulates in mountainous areas where few people live. Why should our listeners tune in to the state of the world's snowpack as the planet continues to warm?
Right. So that snow that's accumulating in the mountains, it might seem kind of distant and far off for a lot of people, but that snow forms a really crucial part of our water supply in many parts of the world. We count on the snow accumulating in the mountains in the winter, which is generally a time of year when demand for water is really low, and snow accumulates and it forms this natural reservoir that will gradually melt out in the streams and soils and rivers in the spring and summer as our demand for that water, maybe far downstream from where it's actually accumulating, but our demand for that water really starts to ramp up for things like irrigation for agriculture or the generation of hydroelectric power as our energy demands ramp up in the summer, or just our domestic everyday water needs.
Well, mountains offer the most complex geography on the planet. How do we even measure snowpack? Are there measuring stations up there or calculations from satellites or what?
Yeah, you're right that snow is incredibly challenging to measure. And there are a couple different ways that we can do it. You can go out and take manual measurements. If there's snow on the ground where you are, you could walk outside. You could take a core of that snow all the way down to the ground, and you could melt that snow, and the amount of water that you have, that would be your snowpack. And we've been doing that for the better part of a century in places like the American West and British Columbia. And lately, in the last 40 years or so, we've developed ways to do that in an automated fashion using some sensors so we don't have to necessarily be skiing out there and taking snow cores. The challenging part of that is that, as you mentioned, snow is accumulating most often in this mountainous terrain, which is incredibly variable place to place. So while the measurement that you take might be a really great estimate of the snowpack at that particular point, things could look very different 100 meters in one direction or the other. And so all these measurements are incredibly valuable and have really formed the basis of our water supply forecasting, again, for the better part of a century in some regions. They're just incredibly challenging to generalize in space. And we also just don't have the kind of dense networks of these measurements that we really need to inform our understanding of snowpack in large swaths of the world where people live and rely on snow water resources. So if we want to get a more spatially complete picture of what snowpack looks like, we could imagine trying to remotely sense it from space using satellites. That gives us the advantages of we can see the whole globe at once, and so we can get measurements in places where we might not be sampling snow on the ground. But there are just certain technological limitations to measuring snow using satellites. Our ability to detect changes saturates pretty quickly after a pretty modest snowpack. So in these mountainous regions where we're accumulating quite a lot of snow in a lot of cases, we're just not able to actually capture the full depth of it. And then the third option we have is using things that we have much better, more spatially complete observations of, like temperature and precipitation, and we can run those observations through process-based models that, you know, take that information of our observations of the climate and do their best to estimate how much snow we wind up with, given our understanding of the physical relationships. But snow is just incredibly challenging to simulate from a process-based standpoint. And so the upshot of all of this is that we have a bunch of different ways of estimating how much snow is on the ground at any given place. But those estimates don't agree with one another particularly well on either the actual magnitude of that snowpack or its variability or even its long-term trends through time. There are large swaths of the globe where we can't even look at all of these different data sets and have really good agreement that snow's been either increasing or decreasing in the long term.
Well, that's going to make it more difficult. Now, to understand your new discovery, first we need to go back in a series of papers by yourself and Justin Mankin to find the phenomenon of snow drought. What does that mean, and can you give us some examples of a snow drought?
We can think of a snow drought as a period of exceptionally low snow. We could think of it as either an entire winter where at no point did we really accumulate much snow, or you could think of it on shorter time scales. Say you start out a winter really dry, you might consider yourself in a snow drought, but maybe you get a couple big storms and come out of it later. Or conversely, you could accumulate snow early, but you have a really warm spring and all that snow melts out early, so you don't have it at those crucial times of year. So there are a bunch of different ways of thinking about snow drought. I would say some of the clearest examples of snow drought that really highlights some of the different flavors of snow drought and some of the different ways that you can get there, if we think about a winter like 2015 on the American West Coast, which really up and down the coast from California up through Washington and into British Columbia was an exceptionally low snow year. But the ways that we arrived at those low snowpacks looked very different. In California, that was a year that was just incredibly dry. It was cold enough in most cases that if the precipitation had been there, it would have fallen as snow, but the moisture supply just wasn't there, and so there was a record low snow year. On the other hand, if we look up more into the Pacific Northwest and up into parts of British Columbia, it was a plenty wet winter. It was incredibly wet, but it was so warm that all of that precipitation was falling as rain instead of snow, and so we were never accumulating much snow. So we can think of these different flavors of snow droughts as dry snow droughts on the one hand, where the moisture just isn't there and so you're not accumulating snow, or these warm snow droughts where the moisture might be there, but it's just so warm that either you're getting rain instead of snow or snow that's on the ground is melting out. And our expectation as the planet continues to heat up is that these warm snow droughts are going to become more and more common.
You say the snowpack is not behaving like a sentinel for climate change. As Figure 1 in the paper says, observed long-term warming trends are robust throughout the Northern Hemisphere, but snowpack trends are not. Why isn't snow accumulation acting in lockstep with warming?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One, which we already talked about, was that snow is just incredibly challenging to measure and estimate. And so we have this fundamental observational uncertainty that makes detecting really coherent trends challenging. I'd say the second is that snow is just incredibly variable year to year, even absent any climate change. Things just can look very different depending on things like whether you're in an El Nino or a La Nina state in a given place. And so given that the background variability is really high and that our observational records of snow are relatively short, on the order of 40 years or so, it can make teasing out the long-term signals pretty challenging. And then finally is that at the same time that the planet is heating up, which all else equal we would expect to be reducing snowpacks, that warmer atmosphere can also hold more moisture. And what that does is it increases the potential for precipitation. And what we've seen, what we can see really clearly in our observations, is that over much of the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly in these cold regions where we often expect snow, we've seen enhanced wintertime precipitation from our warming of the atmosphere. And if it so happens that that extra precipitation is falling at times where it's cold enough that it's going to come down as snow instead of rain, you might actually see some warming-driven increases in snow from this enhanced precipitation effect that could potentially either offset slightly or in some cases completely buffer the warming-driven declines that we'd expect.
Tell us more about the magic number that you and Justin discovered where snow can build or not, and what this tells us.
What you're referring to there is what we identify as this snow loss cliff, which starts occurring around minus 8 Celsius or about 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And the crucial importance of that number is that that is the point at which your snowpack starts to become much more sensitive to warming. So if you're somewhere that's incredibly cold in the wintertime, your average winter temperature is less than minus 8, you can warm a little bit, and you're not really going to see a whole lot of a response in your snowpack because you're so cold that even with a bit of warming, your wintertime precipitation is still likely to be snow instead of rain. You're unlikely to get these really warm spells during the winter that can melt out snow that's accumulated on the ground. But as your average temperature gets closer and closer to the freezing point, and again, we really see this start to emerge and accelerate around -8, that degree of warming starts to increase the likelihood that that storm that was snow is now dumping rain instead, or that you get a big thaw that melts out a lot of your accumulated snow. The likelihood of the warming pushing you into those states starts to increase exponentially. And so what that means is that beyond this threshold of about -8 for your average wintertime temperature, each marginal bit of warming is likely to take a larger and larger chunk of your snowpack. And so in places that sit either just beyond or far beyond this threshold, even modest amounts of warming can cause really rapidly emerging and accelerating losses in your snowpack. And that's another part of the reason that documenting snow losses to date has been really challenging, is that this fundamental underlying relationship means that you only start to really notice changes in your snowpack when it's already too late, when you're already in this regime where you're incredibly sensitive to warming. And so in that sense, snowpack really serves as a pretty poor sentinel or a pretty poor canary in the coal mine, which you want to give warning before the miners die, before you're off that cliff and you're in a place where you're rapidly losing snow. But because of this underlying relationship, you only start to see snow losses emerging once you've already gone over the edge of that cliff.
So in an earlier paper, you asked the question, does information about snow drought, however measured and defined, actually improve forecasts of droughts in the warm season? Can we say yes yet?
I think we can. I think a big theme through this and all of our other work is that what happens in the wintertime doesn't just stay in the wintertime. That through a series of connections through the atmosphere, through the land surface, changes to snow in the wintertime can have these cascading effects that affect downstream risks for things like drought or wildfire or heat waves. As we mentioned, snow is this amazing natural reservoir that stores water and then releases it at another time of year. And as that water is entering the system earlier and earlier, when you're getting rain instead of snow or that snow is melting out earlier, the likelihood that you're going to have that water available during these really hot, dry times of year starts to go down and makes you much more susceptible to things like drought and wildfire in the warm season.
In this new paper in Nature, your team goes global, away from the American West, into the global scene, and here is a case right out of the headlines. The New York Times reports January 16th, Snowcat Nanda and Samir Yasir ask, "It's January at a big Himalayan resort. Where's the snow?" And they report, quote, "A dry winter has been devastating to Gulmarg, one of Asia's highest ski resorts in Indian-controlled Kashmir." Would your study method pick up this kind of thing, and would it be able to judge whether human-induced warming is a contributing cause?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are not able in our work to make many confident claims about what is going on in the Himalaya or the massively populated river basins, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Indus, that the snow that accumulates in those mountains feed. And that is in large part due to just the incredible observational uncertainty in those areas. As we were talking about earlier, it's really challenging to estimate snowpack in mountainous terrain, and the Himalaya are bar none the area of the most dramatic topographic relief on the planet. So it makes estimating snow in those regions really difficult, and our estimates there don't agree with one another particularly well. The other thing that has prevented us from being able to really clearly identify a fingerprint of climate change on Himalayan snowpack is that fundamental problem of causal inference in climate change, where we only have the one planet that we live on. We don't have the really nice, think medical randomized control trial where we have a bunch of Earths and we emit on some of them and we don't emit greenhouse gases on the other. And then we can compare snow on those two planets to estimate what is the causal effect of our emissions on snowpack. We don't have that. What we do have are climate models, which are these incredibly complex computer programs that simulate the physics of the atmosphere and the oceans and the cryosphere and the land surface and all of their interactions with one another. And what these climate models do is they let us estimate these counterfactuals. We can run models with our historical greenhouse gas emissions, and we can run those exact same models without them and see what the differences in a quantity like our snowpack are on those two worlds and really estimate that counterfactual. But what it relies on is our ability to accurately simulate regional responses to temperature and precipitation to understand what that counterfactual world looks like where we haven't caused changes to precipitation and temperature and the resulting snowpack. And our models just really don't agree with one another particularly well in the Himalaya on what the response of temperature and precipitation has been to climate change. Again, for many of the same reasons that it's difficult to measure snow there, it's just given the coarse spatial scale of these climate models and the incredibly dramatic topographic relief of a place like the Himalaya and the amount of small-scale processes that are occurring there that shape the vertical temperature profile and the amount of precipitation that they're getting, it's incredibly challenging to simulate the climate of that region. And because of that, our climate model estimates of how temperature and precipitation and snow have responded to climate change don't agree with one another particularly well, which makes it challenging to identify that human fingerprint.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is researcher Alex Gottlieb, and we're talking about human-forced changes to winter snowpack and, of course, drought downstream the following summer. People who need to know, the people who make decisions and those who pay the price, they need forecasts specific to their river basin. Have we progressed to the point of being able to provide those forecasts?
I think we have, at least in terms of our long-term expectations of what snowpack and subsequent runoff from that snowpack are. In this work, we're able to dive down beyond the scale of just generally what has climate change done to snow across the Northern Hemisphere to what has it done in these highly populated river basins. And in a number of them, we're able to identify this really clear anthropogenic fingerprint of our emissions have caused long-term snowpack declines, and we're able to put numbers on that. We see it most strongly in some of the major river basins of the United States, think the Colorado, the Great Salt Lake, and many of the major river basins in Europe, too, like the Danube and the Vistula. And so we're actually able to, at this really more human and decision-relevant scale, say that, yes, climate change has been causing decreases in snowpack, and yes, we are seeing less runoff in the spring and summer because of that. But I think what this work shows is that even in places where we're not able to clearly detect or changes in snowpack over the long term, or maybe we can detect changes, but we can't necessarily attribute them to our human greenhouse gas emissions, what this snow loss cliff idea, this fundamental underlying relationship between your average winter temperature and your sensitivity of snowpack to warming shows, is it shows what the future might look like in some of these places. Depending on what your average wintertime temperatures are, you may already be in a regime where you can expect really rapid and accelerating snow loss in the future with even a modest amount of warming. Or say you're just to the left or just on the brink of that cliff, we can see how our sort of fundamental underlying snow regime might change with warming in the future, and whether you're going to be in a place that even with a lot of warming is going to be pretty insensitive, and so maybe we don't need to be concerned about snow and warming in these really cold places. But in most of these really highly populated places where people live, they're either just on or just over the edge of this cliff. And I think what it highlights is that the long-term expectation of accelerating snow loss in these places is really clear, and that is a future reality that we need to be planning for now.
Well, surely some of these basins are also home to major food export crops, and could snow drought trend threaten world supplies in coming decades? And or would there be some places which will get more moisture that could make up for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really, I think, fundamentally depends on our ability to adapt to these changes in snow and the fact that this natural reservoir that we've relied on that accumulates snow in the winter and then melts out in the spring and summer, where we're using that water for irrigation to grow our food crops, that timing is going to change, that moisture is just not going to be bridged between the winter and the summer when we need it in the same way. And so what it would really take would be really substantial and politically contentious investments in infrastructure to change our water management approach, such that if that water during the winter is coming down as rain instead of snow, that it's not just bouncing off the land surface and ultimately making its way to the oceans, that we're still able to make productive use of it. So it's going to require a really fundamental shift in how we think about capturing and managing water to have that water still be available during the growing season.
As a person living in the Western Fire Zone, and for people around the world who are worried about fire, smoke, and CO2, I was particularly interested in a presentation you and Justin did at the Western Snow Conference. What did you find out about the relationships between snowpack and wildfires the following summer?
Sure. So there we were really building off of an existing body of work that had identified this relationship where following low snow winters, or winters where maybe you have snow but it melts out early, that those winters tend to be followed by really bad wildfire seasons. In years where you have a lot of snowpack and that snowpack persists late into the spring, those tend to be lower fire years. And so what we were doing in our work that we presented at that conference was trying to see how robust this relationship was to some of those fundamental underlying data uncertainties that I was talking about earlier, that the fact that all of our different estimates of snowpack don't necessarily agree with one another that well. And so what we did was we looked at how consistent this snow and wildfire relationship was across all of these different snow data sets, which I think is just generally an approach that we take in our work, is treating uncertainty, in this case, our observational uncertainty in snowpack, as a source of information and not just noise that causes us to wring our hands and say we can't really claim anything. By looking at this full range of estimates, even if they don't agree with one another very well, we're able to identify places where there's really strong consilience across them of a particular signal. And in this case, we're able to identify that in a bunch of Western U.S. basins, that regardless of which snow data product we look at, this relationship between low snow winters and bad wildfire seasons held pretty consistently.
You are at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Has human forest warming changed the snowpack in the Appalachian Mountains of New England?
Absolutely. The Northeast U.S., where I'm sitting right now, was one of the places, along with the American Southwest and a lot of Western and Central Europe, where we were able to identify this really clear human fingerprint on our long-term snowpack trends. And we estimate that in the Connecticut River Basin, where I'm sitting right now, that climate change has been reducing our snowpack by about 10% a decade or so over the last 40 years. So you multiply that out, and back in 1980, which is around when our study period started, there would have been about 40% more snow come March in the Connecticut River Basin where I'm sitting than there is now, and that decline is due to anthropogenic climate change.
Other than slashing human greenhouse gas emissions, what can we do to prepare for this change in winter snow storage? What do you advise, Alex?
You know, I think water managers in places like the American West and really across the world, they know their systems incredibly well. They know the challenges that they're going to face in a warming climate, which we highlight. And I think it's really just about giving these people the resources that they need to do the long-term planning adaptation that is absolutely necessary to adapt to a less snowy future. So much of our decision-making and our investments are built in this crisis management framework where we have one really low snow year and an emergency gets declared and that frees up some resources. But what our work shows is that we can't just hop from crisis to crisis. We can't operate in this emergency framework when we're in a fundamentally different snow regime, and that we only expect those losses to accelerate and get worse. And so now is really the time that we need to be doing that long-term planning and investment in infrastructure to manage this changing hydroclimatic regime that we're in. So I think it's really just a question of, you know, a shift in our perspective in what we're willing to invest our resources in. And it has to be away from crisis to crisis and towards planning for these fundamental long-term changes.
What are you working on next?
The approach that we take in this paper is very water security focused, trying to tie these human-caused declines in snowpack to their downstream water security implications. But the fact is that the impacts of something like snow loss are going to be felt very differently in different regions. In somewhere like the American West, maybe those water security concerns are paramount. In somewhere like where I am in northern New England, water security from snow maybe isn't as big of a deal because we're somewhere that gets pretty even precipitation in each month of the year. And so we still have water coming into our system in the warm season when we really need it. But on the other hand, I live in a place where there are entire local economies built around this expectation of a nice, consistent snowpack throughout the winter. Think winter recreation, like skiing or logging and forestry, which is really dependent on having frozen ground and a good snowpack on top of that to be able to operate in the woods during the winter. And so these economies are just going to experience pretty dramatic socioeconomic disruption as snow gets less and less reliable in the future. And so part of the work that we're doing is really trying to quantify what the impacts of snow loss are in different places. To zoom out a little bit, that's one of the overall focuses of our research, is trying to really assiduously document the costs of climate change. In this particular case, we're looking at snow, but I think writ large, we're really systematically underestimating the costs of climate change, and as such, we're underestimating the costs of inaction on climate change. And so by documenting the socioeconomic impacts of some feature of climate change, in my case, snow loss, and really documenting what those costs are, we hope that we can make a much stronger case for really rapid and dramatic climate action to avoid those kinds of accelerating impacts that we expect.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, in Dartmouth College, we have been speaking with graduate student and published scientist Alex Gottlieb. He leads the new paper in the prestigious journal Nature, Evidence of Human Influence on Northern Hemisphere Snow Loss. You can find links to the Mencken Lab and all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Alexander, thank you for taking us through this breakthrough science.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. I had a great talk.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.